Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live on this Monday. Got a great couple hours for you. We're going to talk about the Pope. And the Pope, we'll probably talk about our Pope, the current Pope, Pope Francis. But we'll talk about the Pope in terms of the papacy as well. What is the Pope? What does the Pope do? What is the Pope all about? Why do we have one? What are we supposed to do with the one we got? All that. And you're welcome to get in on that conversation. Whether you're Catholic or not, you're welcome. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. Our guest, if you listen to this show very much, you know I'm a fan of his, Joe Heschmeyer, from Shameless Popery. What do you call it, Nick? A website or a podcast? Podcast, right? Blog. All right, I always get all the words confused. Blog, Shameless Popery. Now he's got a book out for us here at Catholic Answers called Pope Peter, Defending the Church's Most Distinctive Doctrine in a Time of Crisis. I don't know how when you wrote this, you knew it was going to be a crisis on the day you called, but hello, Joe Heschmeyer.
How are you doing?
I am very well. I think you probably have to change that subtitle to Crises. I think crisis was underdoing it.
I'm a perennial optimist. It's one of my major faults.
Well, I don't think that's a fault, Joe. Okay, so I'm reading in here. You are like a lot of people live on the planet today who are Catholic, for whom basically John Paul was the Pope from the time you were aware of popes. And then you got Benedict. So that sets a certain pattern of the Pope as a certain kind of, European theological figure, you know, that these PhD types that both of them are, who are not just religious leaders, but also just big intellectuals in their own right. And did growing up with those two popes affect the way that you thought about the job of the Pope and the role of the Pope?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's probably true for almost everyone on the planet. Definitely being someone who was born in the mid-80s and who grew up, the story I would give is just this, you know, in the, like, I think it was, I don't know, maybe the Gather hymnal, they have like the rite of the mass and it says we pray for, and then there's like a red N, our Pope, and N, our bishop. So you can put in the names. And I remember as a kid being like outraged they wouldn't just write John Paul. Like I thought they were like...
like they're offending him or something?
Exactly. They refused to acknowledge he's the Pope. Because it was like, he's always been the Pope. Like he's been the Pope my whole life.
Funny. Yeah. Yeah. So the thing is, globe-trotting media superstar, hyper-intellectual, multilingual popes, that's not necessarily... none of that is necessarily essential to the job description.
Not only is it not essential to the job description, but it's not even close to the norm. I mean, if you really understand the history of the papacy, if you want a historical analogy, I would say from 1198 to 1216, you have the pontificate of Pope Innocent III. And Innocent was the first major like canon lawyer pope after a long string of like monk popes. Mm-hmm. So these monk popes, they weren't intellectuals, but they were great models of holiness. And as a canon lawyer pope, Innocent was a tremendous administrator, but he wasn't what people thought of the pope as. Like people's expectation of what the pope should act like and do, that wasn't him. But he did tremendous work. Just we had to kind of recalibrate our expectations. So if you want to do just a brief list of Innocent III's accomplishments,
yeah.
He approved the Franciscans, he approved the Dominicans, he condemned the Waldensians. He created the modern kind of machinery of the papacy in terms of doing things like canonizations. He was incredibly prolific in terms of administration, paperwork, all that stuff. He really helped the church as an institution, as an organization, run smoothly, and it paved the way for the spiritual renaissance of scholasticism. But it's not necessarily, like, he's never been canonized himself. So the normal things we would expect, you know, just like the personal model of holiness, that's not what he's most remembered for. He's most remembered for just being really good in these other areas. I'm not saying if you're really good in those other areas, you don't have to be a saint. I am saying, like, there have been all of these eras and ages in the church where what we expected out of the Pope has evolved or changed based on the age, but also based even on the man himself.
So Francis then, by the way, if you want to participate in our conversation about Pope Peter, the book Pope Peter Defending the Church's Most Distinctive Doctrine in a Time of Crisis, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Questions about the papacy. We're going to have a wide ranging conversation. So you have questions about the papacy, this is your day. Joe's here to answer your questions. 888-318-7884. Okay, so we have these models. And to tell you the truth, I mean, Paul VI in a certain way fits the model. Certainly Pius the 11th, Pius the 12th, even John the 23rd, who's, you know, thought of as this kind of, I don't know, almost Jolly Mary Pope in a way, like Pope Santa Claus or something. He's a profound European intellectual in his own right. But then now we get this, we get Pope Francis, who's an eminently prepared person. I mean, he's a very well educated. He's a Jesuit. He's been a Jesuit superior. Not at all a question of preparation, but in style, a very different person.
Yeah, I think he's a great pastor and a great preacher in a lot of ways. He's not known for being a theologian. And I think if he weren't Pope, he wouldn't be like a best-selling theological author. The way someone like, you know, Cardinal Ratzinger before becoming Pope Benedict XVI, people were still flocking to him to see what he had to say.
Yeah.
Just about theology. And even like John Paul II's writings before becoming John Paul II as Karol Wojtyła, like they're fantastic. And they kind of stand on their own apart from the man being Pope. So yeah, I think our expectations were extremely high, and in a way, it's pretty natural that you're going to come back down to earth a little bit. You're not going to get every pope who can speak 11 languages. Like not going to happen every time.
No, you're not. And also, I mean, I don't fault Pope John Paul II in any way in what I'm about to say, but I don't think it's necessary that the popes going forward consider the media personality side of it essential to their work. Like I think it'd be perfectly fine to have popes that you don't actually know that well and that aren't out there in the media as much.
Yeah, I think there's actually a lot that can be said for reclaiming the proper relationship of the episcopacy, you know, the bishops with the laity, and that in some ways having a rock star pope who seems so close to everyone, in a way, it can mess up the role of the bishop, or the bishop becomes kind of viewed as a bureaucratic intermediary, or as someone who's just kind of like a middleman, and a middleman that's not really needed in an information age. And that the role of the bishop is so much richer than that, that he's not just some local functionary. He's a successor to the apostles in his own right. So, yeah, the role of the bishop, the risk is that we kind of sweep that aside. And I know you know this, but like for a long time, in like the 70s and 80s and even into the 90s, there were a lot of disappointing bishops in the U.S. And so I think it was very natural for Catholics who were spiritually starved to say, well, the bishop's not great, but the pope is fantastic. And just kind of like mentally sweep aside the bishop.
Right.
And I think we're having to kind of recalibrate that and say that's not really the right way to live out what it is to be Catholic.
Pope Peter is the book defending the church's most distinctive doctrine. And we're really, I mean, only scratching the beginning of Joe's journey to writing this book, because Joe, you're and at some point I do want to ask you about Pope John Paul II himself asking for help from both Orthodox and Catholic Christians on rethinking the role of the papacy. He himself knew that that moving forward, there had to be some rethinking of this. But I'll ask you about that later. I want to just say that all of this is by way of introduction. What we've been discussing about your own experience of these theologian popes and then this new pastoral style of Pope Francis, it got you asking this very question: what's the essence of the thing? And what am I defending when I'm defending the papacy? Is that right?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And I mean, and to make it even kind of a stronger point in a way, there were certain things Pope Francis was saying and doing that I was really struggling with, that I found very difficult to make sense of. And so there was initially this desire to kind of have a knee-jerk defend the Pope at all costs, everything he says, everything he does. And eventually it led to what I think is a more mature, a little more nuanced understanding of our relationship properly understood to the Pope. But even more than that, like, this is not, this book is not, I want to make that very clear, this book is not centered on like Pope Francis bashing or even particularly Pope Francis defending, but more saying this is a good moment to really examine what do we understand, like you said, the essence of the papacy to be. Because at the end of the day, this is the most distinctive doctrine. This is, you know, I want to make a distinction here between distinctiveness and importance. So something like the real presence in the Eucharist, or, you know, Mary being the mother of God, or of course the divinity of Christ, those things are all more important than the papacy. But you can believe in all of those things and be Orthodox. You can, you know, you can believe in the inspiration of Scripture and be Protestant. So if I want to know whether I should be Catholic specifically, it comes down to one question. Did Christ establish the papacy on St. Peter or not? And if yes, then everyone should be Catholic. If no, no one should be Catholic. And if you understand it that way, it actually makes a lot of the apologetics, a lot of the theological disputes just so much easier, so much simpler.
Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. Calls begin to come in, and you're welcome to call with your questions about the papacy. We're talking about his book, Pope Peter, Defending the Church's Most Distinctive Doctrine in a Time of Crisis. And I'm glad you gave us that definition of distinctive, that this idea that this is what kind of makes you stand out as a Catholic. It doesn't mean it's the most important thing. You know, it's not the Trinity. It's not the teaching on the triune God. But it is the thing that marks us out. Which way do you come down on this? It kind of says whether or not you're Catholic.
Exactly. I mean, so like a truck bed is what distinguishes it from a car, but a truck's engine is more important.
Yeah, fair enough. Again, 888-318-7884, the number. Your calls welcome while we talk about Pope Peter, and we'll be right back to do that with Joe Heschmeyer after this.
We're glad you're with us. Stick around for more Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
There is tremendous power in prayer, because when we acknowledge that we don't have the power, but God does, things then begin to move for our good. Remember Matthew 19:26. But Jesus looked at them and said to them, "With men, this is impossible, but with God, all things are possible." Now that's power.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's a wonderful world we live in. A lady bought some eggs and hatched some ducks from it. Did you guys see that news story? She bought some eggs and then she took them out and ducklings hatched out of them. Yeah, that's a good world. If you have a world like that, you're living in a good world. You're also living in a good world when you're on the air with Joe Heschmeyer, our friend, the man behind Shameless Popery, the author now of a brand new book, Pope Peter, Defending the Church's Most Distinctive Doctrine in a Time of Crisis. Our number, if you want to get on with Joe, 888-318-7884. Before I go back to my conversation with Joe, I want to let you know, however, two things about the book. One, it's 25% off if you buy it right now. Because Joe's on the air, and it'll stay that way for another 24 hours. 25% off if you go to shop.catholic.com and buy your copy of Pope Peter, Defending the Church's Most Distinctive Doctrine in a Time of Crisis. The other thing you should know about it is we'll give it to you 100% off if you get on the air with Joe. 100% off means free. I never was good in math. I'm pretty sure that means free. 888-318-7884, the number. Joe, I got a million questions, but I feel like I should go to the phones. You want to take a few calls, and then I'll ask you my questions, and we'll do it that way today?
I think if otherwise, you're going to get all the books.
That's true. I could just hog them to myself. First book is going to Washington State. Oh, I will get in trouble if you call from, I'm not going to say who I will get in trouble with. I don't want to embarrass Marie. But if you call from, like, Australia, I can't promise to send you a book. Marie literally rolling her eyes at me. Hassan in Washington State listening on 100.7 FM. You are up first today, Hassan. Your question for Joe. Nope. I don't think he wants the book. He doesn't want to talk. No, I thought, I don't know what this, it's going to be that kind of a Monday. I'm just going to keep talking about all the wonderful things in this world, like ducklings coming out of your eggs. I wish I had some ducks. And about Joe Heschmeyer. All right, that's fine. I don't know what happened with Sasan. He was just very quiet when we got to him.
You might have counted your eggs before they hatched there.
Thank you, Joe Heschmeyer. All right, so let me ask you this, Joe. If we had to say, like, the papacy, as you described it before Pope Innocent, would be very, very different from what we have today. I mean, with no papal canonizations and, you know, all the organization of the church so different and all that. So in what way is it still the same office? In what way is it still, you know, the Pope in 450 and the Pope in 1450 and the Pope in... 1950 and now are occupying the same office?
Yeah, so I think that's a good question. I think it's the right way to approach it. And I purposely spend all but the last chapter in the book looking just at Peter in the first century. And then the last chapter is on the post-Petrine papacy. And the basic idea is this, like, I'm going to take a grim example. If you had a kid go missing for like 20 years, say like a 7-year-old. Apologies in advance if this is hitting too close to home for parents or whatever. But then 20 years later, you're in the mall or something. You see a kid who's a spitting image of what your kid looked like 20 years ago. A 7-year-old playing in the mall. You would know to a certainty that that was not your kid, because your kid by now is going to be 27. Is going to be grown up. Is not going to still look like a 7-year-old. So. Something similar is kind of applicable here. In Matthew 13, Jesus compares the kingdom to a mustard seed that grows into a mustard tree. So he's saying it's not going to look the same in 450 as it does in, 2020, as it does, God willing, in the year 4000, whatever. Like, it's going to grow. It's going to expand. It's going to evolve in an organic way, if you want to put it that way. And that process of growth is literally promised from the very beginning by Jesus. So someone who says our church looks just like the church in the first century is declaring to you that they don't have the true church, because it shouldn't still look like a mustard seed, because we're not in the days of the mustard seed. That'd be the first thing I'd say.
Okay, so but as far as the office goes, first of all, I really like that argument. I really like what you just had to say there, because So for a lot of reasons, that's a helpful apologetic point. But there is the person who can say, there was nothing like this, what this papacy that you have now in the early church. If I go back to there's just nothing like it.
So I think there's two things to say there. First, you should probably send them a copy of the book, or they, even better, can go and buy the book, shop.catholic.com. And I think you'll see through a series of scriptural arguments that there are such things. There's at least a strong biblical argument that most people aren't even aware of. But the second is that we would expect the office of the papacy to look very different with the growth of the whole church. Mm. So, take something like Apple computers, right? Steve Jobs, when he's first starting it, he's just tinkering in his bedroom, and then eventually expands into the garage, and then it gets a little bigger from there. And that is still the same headship over Apple that we see later on when it's a multi-billion dollar company. Well, we wouldn't expect it to look the same. So if the organization changes, the role of leadership also changes. And in one of the most obvious ways the role of leadership always changes is that you have less time on the front lines when you have a larger and larger and larger organization. That's true in business, that's true in the church, it's true kind of you name it. So yeah, I'd say like, the role of the papacy looks very different than it used to. It's not true that there was no papacy. I think we see very, very clearly, in addition to Peter, who I focus on in the book, obviously, we can look at the first letter of Clement in the year 96. The church in Corinth has a major dispute over their clergy, and the Apostle John is alive at the time. But instead of writing to John, they write to the Pope in Rome, Clement, and he responds, and we still have his letter. So his response is in 96. We don't know where their letter, what year their letter arrived, but we know it was early enough that he's apologizing for the delay in responding. And he settles the dispute, and they continue to keep the letter for decades after that, reading it during the liturgy alongside of Scripture. That's 96. You go another 100 years forward, not even 100 years forward, to 170, and you've got Pope Victor the First, who throws his weight around and excommunicates all of the churches in what's now Turkey. So, I mean, you definitely see people acting like the Pope in the first century and in the second century, and there's a strong biblical case to be made that you see it in the life of St. Peter as well.
Let's go to Carl in Kansas City, in Kansas, listening on 100.5 FM. Hi, Carl.
Hello.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear your voice, Carl. I wasn't sure the phones were working. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Yeah, I said that I don't believe that Peter, the disciple, was the first pope. I don't believe he had time to be a pope. He was crucified upside down. And he, like me, accepted Christ as the Lord and Savior. And he became a saint when he did that. I became a saint when I accepted Christ. And I sure wouldn't want somebody praying to me when I die.
So, Carl, let me just get something clear, so that I have it clear for Joe to respond to. Your sense is that Peter didn't have time to be the Pope?
No, because he was Christ's disciple. And he was crucified upside down. When did he become Pope?
Very good. Thank you, Carl. Joe, what do you say to that?
Yeah.
When was he ever Pope?
Yeah, Carl, first of all, thank you for the question. It actually is really important because it helps to clarify what we do and don't mean about what it is to be Pope. I think there are a lot of misunderstandings about that. And so I think it's worth just tackling it directly from Scripture. So, because this is one of the big kind of controversies. Where do we see anything about the Pope in the New Testament? You know, you'll hear that kind of argument all the time. And I would say, let's start with the Last Supper. Let's start with Luke 22, because it's there that we find the apostles arguing about which of them is the greatest. This is in verse 24. And Jesus lays out for them what leadership in the church is going to look like. And he says, the kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship. And those in authority over them are called benefactors. But then he says, don't let it be like that with you. Rather, let the greatest among you become as the youngest, and the leader is one who serves. And he gives himself as a model of this. He says, I am among you as one who serves. Then he promises that they'll continue to have this kind of leadership and authority in the church, that he's going to appoint them to eat and drink at his table in his kingdom and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. In other words, the church is not some passing, fleeting institution. The apostolic foundation isn't something even just for this life, but rather is something that is timeless, that Christ sets on to continue forward into eternity. But notice that the critical part here is he's just said, what we're expecting with leadership is not someone to just throw their weight around and like push everybody around and just boss everyone around. No, properly understood, just like the authority of a father in a family, the authority of a leader in the church is one of service and self-sacrifice and self-denial. And it's this power of service because Christ is among you as one who serves. So then immediately after that, that was 24 to 30 in Luke 22, immediately after that, in verse 31, Jesus says to one of the 12 who were there, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan demanded to have you, and that is you plural, like you all, like you 12, that he might sift you all like wheat. Okay, now he's saying there's a demonic attack coming to destroy this apostolic foundation. And you might say in response to that, all right, well, maybe Jesus will pray for all 12 of them. But it's not what he says. In verse 32, he switches from the plural to the singular, and he says, but I have prayed for you, you singular, that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned back again, strengthen your brethren. In other words, immediately after telling Peter after telling the 12, rather, that power is for service, that authority is for service in the church, that it's not just about lording your authority over other people, but it's about taking this opportunity of authority to serve, and that all of the 12 have this authority in relationship to the church, he then gives one of the 12, Simon Peter, that authority in relationship even to the other 11, that he is told to strengthen your brethren. That is, if servant leadership is the biblical model of authority, Peter is given servant leadership even over the other 11. So that's where I would say we see Peter very clearly being given the authority and the duty of what the papacy is. So if that doesn't sound like the papacy, I think it's because we don't understand what the papacy is.
Carl, thank you so much for your call. You're welcome to hang on the line, and Marie will get your information if you'd like your free copy of Pope Peter, Defending the Church's Most Distinctive Doctrine in a Time of Crisis, the brand new book from Catholic Answers Publishing, and our guest, Joe Heschmeyer. 888-318-7884, the number.
Catholic Answers Live.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
How do we know Jesus founded a visible, organized church? Is today's Catholic Church the same as the Church of the Apostles and the early Christians? What can I say to someone who claims the medieval church became corrupted by pagan ideas and practices? In 20 Answers, The Church, you'll find smart, solid answers to these questions and many more, helping you to understand how the church Jesus founded is able to carry on through history his mission of teaching and sanctifying his followers. 20 Answers, The Church is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the church and the world. All in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com today and take a look at this exciting new series from Catholic Answers Press.
Every Catholic has heard the challenge. How can you believe that? Don't you know the Bible says? It's a challenge we have to meet. If we can't reconcile apparent contradictions between Scripture and Catholic teaching, how can our faith survive? And if we can't answer our Protestant brothers and sisters, how will they ever come to embrace the fullness of the faith? In Meeting the Protestant Challenge, apologist Carlo Broussard gives you the knowledge and tools you need to answer 50 of the most common Bible-based objections to Catholicism. Be prepared to give an answer. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Challenge today by calling 844-239-4952, visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tomorrow on More to Life, so angry.
Are you struggling with anger or angry people? We're here to help.
That's tomorrow on More to Life. Now, back to Catholic Answers.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. He doesn't live in the state of California. And if you're in the state of California, never ask a person on the break what gas costs where they live, because it doesn't cost that here. It costs a different amount, a way higher amount, no matter where else that other person lives. I'm feeling bad about living in California now. Well, we're not talking about that. We're talking about the papacy. Joe has a brand new book for us here at Catholic Answers, a beautiful book, Pope Peter, Defending the Church's Most Distinctive Doctrine in a Time of Crisis. I think it's going to become one of the essential texts for those who would like to know just where did we get this papacy role. The other texts that you're going to want to go with that, the Gospel of Mark, Matthew, Luke, I want to throw John in there. Letters of Peter himself, letters of Paul. Let's go to Salvador in Texas, listening on the EWTN app. Salvador, you there with us?
Yes, I am.
Your question for Joe Heschmeyer.
Yes. I had heard that people were saying that Pope Francis wasn't the true pope and that it was Pope Benedict. I was wondering if I can get some clearance on that.
Yes. Pope Benedict says or Pope Emeritus Benedict, I'm not helping, Pope Emeritus Benedict says that the real Pope is Pope Francis. What he said that was confusing for people is he acknowledged that he still has a sort of spiritual responsibility connected to having been the Pope. And so that was something that threw a lot of people for a loop, because we're not used to having a Pope Emeritus. It's been several centuries since the last one. But if you think about like a retired bishop, like a bishop emeritus, you can see what was kind of being talked about. So, for instance, in my diocese, the Archdiocese of Kansas City in Kansas, the archbishop is Archbishop Joseph Naumann, but the retired archbishop is Archbishop James Patrick Kelleher. And for certain things like confirmations and other things, he will assist. But he also has a certain spiritual connection, having been the bishop of the diocese. And so it isn't like he just loses all. It isn't like, you know, when you trade a baseball player to another team and they just kind of wipe the dust from their feet and they move on. Even as the former bishop, you still have a certain responsibility, you know, spiritually praying for them and sacrificing for them and that sort of thing. Benedict understood that in a way that I think most of us don't, and spoke into that, that he, it wasn't that he was just giving up on the church. It wasn't that he was just giving up even on the Diocese of Rome, but he understood that his time had come and that it was time for him to retire. But he understood also that retirement means something very different as a bishop. To be a bishop emeritus is something very different than something like in the business world or like I said, like a baseball team. So I think that's what was going on. But I think the spiritual nuance and everything going on in there was lost on people, leading them to say, oh, maybe he's still trying to hold on to some vestige of the papacy, et cetera. And he's made it very clear that he wasn't intending to do that. So I don't think it helps to say, oh, the Pope is the guy who says he's not the Pope, not the guy who says he is the Pope.
Salvador, how you feel about that?
I feel so much clearer now. Thank you.
That's what we aim to do. That's why we like Joe Heschmeyer so much, too. You know what'll make you even clearer? If you read this book, Pope Peter. Do you want a free copy of it?
Sure.
That would have been so embarrassing if you said no. I regretted asking it as soon as I asked it, because I thought, what if he says no? So hang on the line. Marie's going to get your information, and we will send it to you, because Texas is not a foreign country. Texas is part of America. Do the Texans know that, Nick? Are the Texans aware of that? Yes, they are. They were once a republic, but they are part of this republic now. 888
There have actually been six flags over Texas. I just want to throw that out there.
Someone should make use of that, six flags over Texas. They should do something with that. Susan in Virginia, which was never an independent republic, listening on the EWTN app. You are next. Your question for Joe.
Actually, we're a commonwealth still today.
Ah, that's right. You're one of like three or four commonwealths, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts,
that's
Virginia.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you for that, Susan. Call again sometime. Bye.
Oh, no, sorry. Interesting fact for today. My question is, in Matthew 16:8, where we as Catholics understand that Jesus was giving the seat of authority to Peter, which was the beginning of the papacy, I have Protestant relatives who hear that and say that when Jesus says, on this rock I will build my church, that he was referring to himself, Jesus. So I was wondering, how do we explain that to people who have that different interpretation?
So thank you for the question. Thank you also for the brief civics lesson on the Commonwealth status of Virginia. You're right. I believe Pennsylvania is also, I don't know if any other states.
Massachusetts.
Oh, yeah, of course. Of course. There's a brewery in D.C. that just does Commonwealth beers, just so you know. But that's neither here nor there. To the more important question, is the rock Jesus or is the rock Peter? I'd say a couple things. The first thing, and I want to primarily cite some of the Protestant authors that I cite in the book. There's a Southern Baptist preacher from the 19th century into the 20th century by the name of A.T. Robinson, who has a lot of like scriptural commentary and exegesis. And he gives kind of the characteristic Protestant examples. I'm giving this just for people who may not be familiar. And he says Jesus makes a play on the name Peter, rock. And what he means there is in Greek, Jesus says, you are Peter, Petros, and upon this rock, Petra, I will build my church. There are a few things we're going to get to, like whether this was even originally Greek or not. But Protestants tend to say, oh, this is a wordplay. And so it's not clear if Peter's Petros, who's Petra. And so Robinson says, well, maybe Jesus could mean himself by this rock if he pointed to himself. And the first thing I'd say to that is, anytime you have to add the critical detail, if he pointed to himself, you know you're doing bad exegesis. Like, you could also say, if he pointed to, like, a particular rock and said, this is where we're going to build, yeah, then, yeah, that would be a pretty important detail. But it rejects something about the authority of Scripture to say the critical information to understand what was meant is something that we don't even have access to. Like, you know, Jesus wants us to understand this passage, but we couldn't possibly understand it because he didn't give us the tools to. So we have to just imagine where he might have been pointing. That's really bad exegesis. But there's another reason, too. So this is actually from a Presbyterian minister by the name of Marvin Richardson Vincent, who says this reference of Petra to Christ is forced and unnatural. If you look at the passage, here's how it goes. They go up to Caesarea Philippi, which is far, far away from where they've been doing ministry for the entire rest of all of the Gospels. And so Jesus takes them basically on a retreat, far away from everything else. And while he's there, he says to them, who do people say the Son of Man is? And then he says, who do you say that I am? And one of them, Simon Peter, inspired by God, says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. So Peter, Simon Peter, confesses Jesus as the Christ. In turn, Jesus says, Simon, you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church. The gates of hell will not prevail, and I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. So in other words, these things happen in this order. First of all, Peter confesses Jesus as the Christ. Then Jesus confesses Simon as Peter. Then he says that he's going to build the church on the rock, Petros, Petra. And then he personalizes it even more by giving the binding and loosing and authority specifically to Peter and giving him the keys to the kingdom of heaven. So all of that is very explicitly to Peter. The idea that halfway in the middle of that, he suddenly switches from talking to Peter to talking about himself without any clear signal that he's switching the target of the blessing. Like, the form of this is the form of a blessing, and Peter's the recipient of the blessing. The Protestant explanation that says the rock is Jesus turns it from Jesus blessing Peter to him switching blessing himself or some third party unnamed, we don't even know what the rock is, and then going back to Peter. So when Marvin Richardson Vincent says this is forced and unnatural exegesis, it's true. It just isn't. Jesus appears in the passage not as the foundation, but as the architect. On this rock, I will build. So Jesus is present in this passage, but present as the architect of the church, not the one upon which the church is built. That's the major point, I would say. But there's one more detail that's really critical. Notice that this whole debate, who is the rock, is premised on the idea that in Greek, there's this distinction between Petros, the masculine form, and Petra, which means rock. And so it's like, oh, well, this is a wordplay, and Petros, since it's two different words, couldn't mean the same person. That's a bad argument in the first place, but it's a worse argument when you read John 1, verse 42, which makes it clear explicitly that the original name wasn't Petros in Greek. It was Kepha in Aramaic. And so and that just means rock. So he just says, you are Kepha, and upon this Kepha, I will build my church. So there's only one referent. It's rock. We know the word in Aramaic. He says, you are rock, and on this rock, I'll build my church. And the only reason we lack that is because Greek is gendered in a way that Aramaic isn't. And so Matthew has to translate it in a way that makes sense into Greek. He's not creating a new separate referent, if that makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense, and I appreciate your going into so much detail.
Thank you very much, Susan. I appreciate that call from the Commonwealth of Virginia. Excuse me, Joe, I think you and I both owe an apology to Kentucky.
Oh, is it also a Commonwealth? I didn't know that.
Yes, it is also a Commonwealth. I'm waiting for your apology, Joe.
I apologize to the good people of Kentucky and all, any other commonwealths we may have missed out on.
Well, like Puerto Rico, that's not a state, though. So, I mean, it's true. So we were saying which states are commonwealths, but Puerto Rico is a commonwealth, or as are
but
the,
you could still,
the Marianas
still
Islands.
Books there, right?
Oh, we could. I don't know. That's a really good question. I'm going to have to ask Marie that. 888-318-7884. The number, Joe Heschmeyer, is our guest. Our topic is the papacy, really. We're talking about the book, Pope Peter, Defending the Church's Most Distinctive Doctrine in a Time of Crisis. This is Joe's brand new book from Catholic Answers Press. We're very proud of it. I hope Joe's very proud of it because it's a very, very fine book. You're a very lucid writer, Joe. I will say that. Reading it, I was like, yeah, this guy can put some sentences together in a clear way. Is that, would you attribute that more to the fact that you are seminary trained or trained as a lawyer? Which of those two made you the clearer writer?
Well, I should also add, I had two different people editing my stuff this time, which definitely helps. So, you know, props to Catholic Answers. But I was actually a debater before I was a lawyer, but I'd say probably, yeah, legal research and writing. That class was the thing that more than anything else helped me to express my ideas in writing a little more briefly than I do in speaking.
All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more. There's a ton of questions. People want to talk with you, but don't worry. We've got Joe for 2 hours. I am in a little bit of a goofy Monday mood. I don't know why. I think it might be because the world is in difficult straits. I get so happy, Joe, when I'm back here on Mondays that I'm a little goofy lately. But I'll work that out on my system during the break. We'll be right back with more of your calls for Joe Heschmeyer.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
I want to talk to you about the importance of bringing the news to you every day. And we do that two ways on Catholic Connection. Firstly, we give you a newscast that I write and give to you to keep you up to date on what's happening in the world in the church. And then we also do interviews daily to help you understand everything from a truly Catholic perspective.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo, tomorrow morning, 9 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Do you want to end abortion, halt the attack on traditional marriage, and ensure religious freedom for ourselves and for our grandchildren? To do this, we must convert the culture. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a grassroots initiative that recognizes this need and takes it to the streets. If you're interested in peacefully sharing the gospel in your area, visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Just going to keep going to the calls because there's a million of them. And we've got Joe Heschmeyer here to talk about his brand new book, Pope Peter, and an opportunity to talk about the papacy. I do want to stress, if you're not Catholic, you're welcome to call. Our first caller, Carl, I got the sense, was probably not Catholic, though he didn't tell us that. Whether you're Catholic or not, if you got questions about the papacy, you're very welcome here. If your questions take the form of something challenging, don't worry. Joe can handle it. Quietly sobbed to myself in the background while he's answering the question, but Joe's tough. He can take it. Let's go to Ignacio in Washington, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Ignacio, are you there with us?
Yes, I am.
What is your question for Joe?
To make it clear, I want to let you know I was Catholic before I was born. And I'm still Catholic. I'll be Catholic forever.
good. Okay. You had me worried there for a minute, Ignacio, but okay, good. I'm glad you'll stay forever.
All right. My question for you is, when did they start using the word pope, and what exactly means? Was Peter already called pope?
Those are really good questions, and they're actually really easy, short questions, because pope just means papa. It means father. It's actually more of a nickname than a title. And so Peter wasn't called that. That, I believe, is the 3rd or 4th century that starts to become commonly used. But I do want to point out one thing, which is that this role of spiritual fatherhood is something we really clearly see in Scripture. So, for instance, like in Romans 4, St. Paul refers to Abraham as the father of all who believe in verse 11. So there's this sense that a spiritual leader is properly referred to as a father, and which is why we call priests father and why we call the Pope the Pope.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ignacio. I really appreciate that. Philip in Southern Maryland, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Philip, thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Your question for Joe.
Can you hear me? How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Hey, Lenio, great to speak to you guys. Listen, a quick question, maybe you might have answered a little bit, but you're citing Luke 22 there, Joe, mm-hmm. and I really like that. My question to you is a little bit more of a, you know, interesting question for me. On the backside of it, when did Peter, or did he realize at any given time when Jesus spoke to him like that, that he was now kind of the primus inter pares, or so the he was the head? Did he know this, or did he just assume, well, I guess I'm the one that's got to get this thing started? I don't know if that makes sense, but I was kind of curious. Was he aware that he was going to be the one in charge?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And there's a sense in which there's probably aspects of it that we can't say without getting in, like, an insight into Peter's soul. I think we can say this. We see him exercising clear leadership from pretty early on. Whether that's because he knows Jesus has given him this kind of authority and leadership, whether that's because he's a natural born leader, is a little difficult to say. But we see him doing things like answering on behalf of the others. But we also see Jesus bringing him, James, and John aside. And then even out of those three, really focusing on training and forming Peter. So I'll give you a couple examples. Only those three are invited on at least one or two of Jesus's miracles, like the raising of the dead girl. Only those three are allowed in the house. Only those three are allowed up on the Mountain of Transfiguration. And while there, one of the evangelists, I believe Luke, refers to the three of them as Peter and the others, which is remarkable because it's actually not even really shorter than just saying Peter, James, and John. And we see that kind of that basic model. Actually, maybe one of the clearest places to see it would be the Garden of Gethsemane. So Jesus goes into the garden with 11 of the 12 disciples. The 12th shows up later. For those who haven't read, I don't want to spoil. And so he brings all 11 into the garden. But then he brings three of them, Peter, James, and John, deeper into the garden with him. All 11 of them fall asleep, and he only rebukes one of them originally, which is Peter. So we see him holding Peter to a higher standard. We see him forming Peter in an intentional way. And I think anyone, like, if you were in a company and the boss was doing that with, like, one employee, I think anyone who can read the writing on the wall would say, this guy's being trained as a sort of successor or being groomed for leadership in some sense. So there definitely seems to be that. But I think in terms of the very clear kind of commissioning, the clearest points actually after the resurrection in John 21, when Jesus says to him three times, Peter, do you love me more than these? And then in response to Peter saying, Lord, I love you. Lord, you know I love you. He says, feed my sheep, tend my lambs, tend my sheep. So he's giving a commitment to the entire flock, to this one guy, Peter, while six other apostles are standing by. So those kind of actions make it very clear that Peter is being called to something over and above even what the rest of the apostles are being called to. When he kind of pieced it together is hard to say, because we know there are plenty of points where Jesus teaches something that in hindsight looks very clear, but maybe they didn't get right away. So I can't answer how quickly Peter got it, but I can say we see the evidence that Jesus was preparing him for it for years.
Philip, what do you think?
That's a pretty good answer. No, that's what I wanted to hear. That was my thought, is just, was he ever aware there was this sense? And I think you answered it. You know, it's not like, because he did fail him, you know, three times after that, you know, denied.
Yeah.
But I like what you said, that he did always, regardless of that, when Jesus forgave me, I think he continued to put him in the first place. So, no, thank you. That was a great answer. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
Thank you, Philip. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest up next, Larry in Freehold, New Jersey, listening on Domestic Church Media. Larry, thank you for your call. Your question for Joe.
Well, hi, Joe. I've got a question about Peter was the rock, right? He's the founder of the church. Why do the popes that's about the middle of the last century seem to be changing so many things? I think the pope's job isn't it to keep things, the doctrine especially, exactly the way it was when Peter was the first pope?
But so
the popes now seem to change everything. And Francis seems to be so involved with married priests, you know, women priests, and all these. And he's so vague. He doesn't, like, if he was a rock, he would say no, you know?
Yeah. There's a couple really good questions, and I want to make a couple distinctions there. So first, it's definitely the job of the Pope in part to preserve the treasury of the faith, whole and entire and intact. But that also means recognizing maybe a deeper understanding. So properly understood, if you trace the history of the church, we do see these moments where, as we meditate on the truth more, like we understand a different aspect or a different angle that maybe we hadn't taken fully into account. To take just one example, the Council of Trent condemns dueling in very strong terms because the church had always said murder is wrong. There was no question about that, but people weren't sure that dueling counted as murder. We could say similar things about something like abortion now. So part of the role of the Pope, or really any leader in the church, is to be in communication with the culture, not to change the doctrine of the church in light of the world, but to be able to give an answer in season or out of season to whatever people are struggling with or what they're dealing with. So it isn't just to, you know, lock away the teachings in a closet somewhere where no one can get to them. That would be the first distinction I would make, that the job of the Pope is actually much more of engaging the world rather than just protecting us from the world. The second is, there is this distinction between what's called doctrine and discipline. So doctrine are, these are the dogmatic truths of the faith, and these can't change in the sense that truth can't change. If 2 + 2 = 4 today, it will be 4 tomorrow. But there are other things which are called disciplines. These are the practices of the church. And take a really kind of silly local example. One of the churches around here has Mass at 8:15. If they decided to move Mass to 9 o'clock, they wouldn't be changing any teaching about the Mass. They wouldn't be changing any. They would only be changing a practice. The practice should reflect the truth of the faith, but the practice isn't the same as the truth of the faith. That's what we mean by a discipline. So there are times where we'll see changes in disciplines, and we've seen them many times throughout the history of the church. After the Reformation, you only have one council between the Council of Trent in the 1560s and Vatican II in the 1960s, and that's Vatican I. Normally, you have about one council, about a little more than one a century. So we had a long period of very little ecumenical council or reform. And so I think we tried to do about 500 years worth of adapting and changing to the circumstances that needed changing to all at once. And I think that kind of abrupt change led to a lot of whiplash and a lot of disruption. There's much, much, much more that could be said about all of that. But I would just say that would be one way of kind of explaining. Those would be the distinctions I'd want to keep in mind. What's the difference between doctrine and discipline? And is the Pope's job only to make sure people aren't teaching heresy? Or is it also to engage with the world in a deep way, too?
What do you think, Larry?
Well, I think that this primary function should be to preserve the values and the doctrine of St. Peter, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Larry. Do you want to respond to that last bit, Joe?
Well, yeah, I think some of it is going to be a difference in style, but I also think that there's definitely room for criticism, right? Like, one part of what the Pope does is clarify these things. So if a Pope isn't doing that, if you're left perennially confused, I do think that there is a sense in which there's a failure in leadership. Now, sometimes people exaggerate that, but I don't think that the solution is to pretend that there aren't real problems as well.
Yeah. Okay. So, but real problems, I guess the question is, and maybe I'll have to get to this with you early in the next hour, but we're talking with Joe Heschmeyer, by the way, the author of Pope Peter, Defending the Church's Most Distinctive Doctrine. If you have a question about the current pope or about the papacy, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884, because we're going to continue for another hour with Joe. But I guess the question that for the next hour, Joe, is how do you maintain unity with the Pope when you're troubled by what he's saying, I guess? Because I think a lot of people are, many people actually asked that question with the prior two popes, but they may have been of a certain, you know, persuasion. And then many people are asking that now of the current pope, and they might be of a different persuasion. But the question is always there, what do I do when I just don't agree with these things the Pope is saying?
Yeah, that'll be a great question. I look forward to getting into it.
Okay, fair enough. All right, I didn't know if you were going to tell me. No, I'm not answering that. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest, Pope Peter, the book, 888 888- 318-7884, the number. Your calls are welcome, and everybody who gets on with Joe gets a free copy of the book. 888-318-7884.